You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you everyone for showing up on this late Thursday afternoon. I should welcome you all, of course. I'm very pleased to see you. It's such a small and intimate setting, I should do this acoustic, but I'll still be using the microphone. I think it's better this way. You know, it's one of the signs of achievement in academia if you can find something which is relatively straightforward and presented in a very complicated way. And I've never been very good at this, but I think that finally with this I have achieved something, because it's true, most people have a vague understanding only of ontological security. Unfortunately, it's not a term that I invented. I would have loved to. It's a well-established term that has recently found its way into international relations theory and is now being used still more. And I'll take you through this, of course, and explain what it is and how I think that it relates to Russia or other actors that we may find in the international system or elsewhere. Before I start my presentation, though, let me just say a few words about the purpose of my visit. I'm part of a Danish military delegation. We flew to Ukraine on Friday, spent a few days there, and just arrived a couple of days ago in Moscow. And we are here for briefings and lectures on security policy, defense policy. We've learned a lot about defense reforms. And we have a presentation here at the endowment just an hour ago. And we arranged it so that I could stay and discuss with you an ongoing topic that I'm working on. As research director at the Danish Defense College, I don't have time. I don't have time to do research. Whatever time I do have, I spend on a few projects, and this is one of them. I wrote an article in Danish on this topic. It's a full article. It's well developed, the whole argument. But I'm now in the process of turning it into an English language article, which will probably be more theoretical. So any questions or comments that you may have are more than welcome, and I may incorporate it into my future work. All right. With this, let's turn to the topic, which is Russia and the search for ontological security. I should say to those of you who are situated over here, you may want to position yourself so that you can see the screen. All right. First, on ontology, which a lot of you are familiar with. This is something that a lot of you will know from the philosophy of science. I've found a citation here from a textbook on the philosophy of science, and explains that ontology is that bit of philosophy which studies what sorts of things exist. So it has to do with existence. And it's used in philosophy of science to denote different phenomena, material as well as immaterial, that exist in the world today. Ontological security, then, is security for one's self. It has to do with our sense of existence and the extent to which we sense ourselves as well as individuals in this world. Traditionally, it has been applied mostly in psychology and developmental psychology, and it's actually well known within psychology and in sociology. Pioneering work was done back in the 1960s on the relation between the individual and the surrounding environments, or between, if you want, the self and other forces that exist, other phenomena that exist in the world. Scottish psychiatrist David Lank did some pioneering work back in the 1960s, and he was interested in a way that the external, in a way that external forces have an impact on the psychology, the psychological makeup of the individual. He did not use the term ontological security, but in essence, this was what he was looking at. Ontological security, so psychologists tell us, for the individual is founded in the first years of existence. This is done primarily by the so-called main or primary caretakers, usually the parents. It could be someone else, but it's usually the parents. And the parents, through daily routines and through the interaction with the infant, give the infant a sense of existence, a sense of being separate from the rest of the world that will continue for the rest of their life. It is also true that some people don't have this sense of firm existence. They may find it difficult to distinguish themselves from their surroundings. They don't have that firm inner core. Once established, is then maintained through these stable relationships and predictable roles. So there's routine to what we do. So routinization of social life, and that helps sustain this sense of ontological security. It's never lost, but it's then maintained and routinized through these stable relationships. I mentioned David Lang just before. Here's a citation from a book that he did. And I should mention this is not published in 2006. His original work is more recent. But David Lang then explains about how this ontologically secure person lives her life. And he explains that an ontologically secure person will experience his own being as real, alive, and a whole. His identity and his autonomy is never in question. He finds that there is a continuum in time. Some of these people talk about this temporal continuity, that you see your life not as a series of separate incidents, but as a as a whole. So there's this temporal continuity. There's a narrative to your entire being that is non-interrupted. And the existence will have an inner consistency, substantiality, genuineness, and worth. Unfortunately, of course, not everyone feels like this. We should say, or I should add, of course, that it's difficult to deal with ontological security, even in this sense, at the individual level, because we don't sense it. People tell us that we do have some degree of ontological security. Some people have a lot, some people have less, some people hardly have any. This is an example. This is taken from a book by Carl Rogers, who's a very famous U.S. Psychologist, the founder of Rogerian psychotherapy. And Carl Rogers, in his book, recalls this session he had with an ontologically insecure woman. And this woman comes to Carl, to see Carl Rogers because she has an obvious she has obvious problems, and she explains to Carl Rogers that her problems has reached the point where she just didn't stand up for her convictions, and now she doesn't know if she have any convictions at all. She explains that she hasn't been really honest being herself. She doesn't really know what her true self is anymore, and it's like she's been playing some kind of false role. And this woman clearly has been playing. Or living her life according to the expectations of others, or how she felt that others would expect her to act in particular situations. And Carl Rogers, I guess, tells her to try and break free from this, try to find her inner core, and to establish a role for herself that is separate from that of her surroundings. People like this woman, people who lack in an extreme way ontological security, may feel that the whole world is a mess. And the British security theorist Bill McSweeney, in one of his books, also talks about ontological security, and he compares this to candid camera. And what is interesting about candid camera, what makes it fun to watch, is that. Otherwise stable social roles are deliberately broken down. This is really the essence of candid camera. So you walk into a mall or you walk into another place and you have certain expectations and you have good reason to have these expectations about your own behavior and the behavior of others. But people deliberately break out of character and thus put you in a very awkward situation. And this is the essence of candid camera. And security theorists and psychologists in particular tell us that there are people with an extreme lack of ontological security who go through life like this. That they have this sense that there are no routinized roles, that they are unsure about their own role and about the roles of others. So every new social encounter, in a way, is a nightmare for these people, and it's a new situation every time, and they hardly know what to expect. In recent years, as I said in the introduction, this whole idea of ontological security for the individual has been elevated to the collective level. So it's now being used for different types of collectivities. It could be tribes, it could be nations, other kinds of collectivities. And these collectivities are now given, are now said to have the same fundamental need for ontological security, for a sense of who they are, as we as individuals do. I have talked about this at home in presentations, and based on this, I may add that some people find this extremely controversial and provocative. And I did one presentation, and one man got up, and he was furious. And he said that this was the most vulgar thing he ever heard. That you will take an individual need and elevate that to a collective level. Keeping that in mind, I still think this is a very useful analytical tool, and I think it's a tool that explains very well certain, numerous conflicts, for instance, that we may find in the world today. It has been applied recently at the collective level, for instance, at the Arab-Israeli conflict, and the sense, the strong need for a firm understanding of the self on both the Israeli and the Palestinian side. And the problem, of course, is that in this conflict, the self is defined in direct opposition to the other, so that they get their strong sense of existence from the conflict. It's also been applied, for instance, to states who find it difficult to accept any part in genocide. It goes against their understanding of who they are. And if they accept that they have been part to genocide, it will fundamentally shake and challenge their understanding of who they are, and thus give them a weaker sense of ontological security. So their understanding of who they are will be thrown into the air, and it's simply too painful for some of these people. This was just
a remark to tell you that I do realize this is controversial. I'll be happy to discuss it with you afterwards. This process of elevating the individual need to the collective need. As I mentioned, with the individual, ontological security is established in the first years of existence, and it's then maintained throughout life, and it comes to an end, of course, at the time of death. For the collectivity, though, if we accept that it can be elevated to the collective level, it would have to be different. So ontological security is something that we inherit from previous generations. So whether it's a tribe or it's a nation or it's another collectivity, they will pass on to us an understanding of who they are and of who we are, and with that, a sense of ontological security. But this understanding of who we are is not constant. It's constantly renegotiated. It's not a permanent identity. So the identity, usually the identity that we find, for instance, a generation later, could be quite different from the one that was inherited. Right now in Western Europe, we find that our understanding, our national understanding is challenged, for instance, by a European identity. And this is something that causes problems, I believe, in a number of states, including my own, Denmark, which is quite Eurosceptic. And I think it has to do with this also, that our understanding of ourselves as a nation is changing, and it has been radically challenged by the understanding that we are also Europeans, in the EU sense of the term. But for the collectivity, as for the individual, it's also true that this sense of ontological security, this sense of existence, is maintained through stable relationships. And again, it has to do with the routinization of different roles, the roles that we play, and the roles that others play, and the interaction between these different actors. Finally, before we turn to Russia and the Russian identity, I give you a citation, a quote here from Charles Taylor, who is, I believe, a Canadian philosopher. And Charles Taylor explains that in order to have a sense of who we are, he says, we need to have a notion of how we have become and of where we are going. And again, I talked about this temporal continuity. There has to be an uninterrupted narrative in our lives as individuals, but probably also in the existence of collectivities. Now, before we turn to the Russian case study, I would like you to imagine just for a second that we are at Carl Rogers' office, and this poor woman that we met earlier has just left the office, and there's a knock on the door, and his next client walks in, takes a seat in the chair just opposite from him, and tries to explain, or starts to explain, all the problems that he has. Now, when you look at Putin like this, it's clear that, he doesn't really have any problems. He hasn't come to see Carl Rogers because he has a personal problem that needs to be dealt with. He's here because of another issue. He represents something that is far bigger. But in essence, the problem that he brings with him is essentially the same as the woman who just left the office. And Putin explains to Carl Rogers that it's like we've been playing a kind of role. We didn't quite live up to defend our convictions. It's reached the point we don't really know if we have any convictions at all. We've been playing a kind of role. We haven't been quite true to our true self. And in general, we just try to accommodate and to live up to the expectations of our surroundings. And it reached the point now where we need to find our inner core and to really define who we are in relation to others. And I see the psychotherapy that Putin has given the Russian population in the way that I'll just present now. I use the term psychotherapy, of course, in a humorous manner, but I actually do believe that Putin has given the Russian population a kind of psychotherapy, and I also believe whatever you think of his presidency, whatever you think of the psychotherapy, I actually believe that this is one of his greatest achievements, and I think it's something that is often overlooked, and I think it forms part of his huge success. It's something that is often generally, of course, not articulated, but I'll try to explain how I see the essence of this. First, I've tried to identify a number of elements from what I term the old identity. The Soviet Union was made the constituting other of Russia. So everything the Soviet Union was not, Russia was. And everything that the Soviet Union was, Russia was not. So this was a mirror image. This was black and white. As part of this, it had to be a liberal state. It had to be a state that celebrated the individual. So it placed a high premium on individualism. And because of the redefinition of its identity, it also redefined its interests. And its interests now included, naturally, a close cooperation with the West. Identities were the same, and because of this, interests would also be the same. I should add to this, of course, then when I talk about interests as defined by identity, I speak within a constructivist paradigm, of course. This is social constructivism at its best, for some at its worst. But I should tell you that openly, of course. This is within social constructivism. The problem, though, is that Russians too often found themselves as victims of candid camera, in the same way that Bill McSweeney explained, that they had certain expectations to the roles that they had to perform and to the roles of others. But far too often, they found that these roles did not match. And it was a very awkward and, in many ways, I guess, very painful situation. I see several reasons for this. One is deliberate political engineering. Dmitry Trenin, who was here just an hour ago giving us a presentation, has written on this, for instance. Others have as well. And they have demonstrated how there were political forces in this country, including the military, of course, who even in the early 90s were looking for an external enemy. So if they could find someone out there who could justify continued high military spending, for instance, or who could justify a conservative foreign policy line, then that would be great. And they managed to do so. An external enemy was identified. It was the West in general, NATO more specifically, perhaps. Studies have shown, for instance, how, in general, Russian politicians skillfully convinced at least a large part of the Russian electorate that the West was actually a more acute problem than they would otherwise have felt. In the literature, I believe this is referred to as exogenous preference formation. This is when politicians convince the electorate of something that otherwise the electorate would never have dreamt of. And in this case, they managed to identify this external enemy that played the role that was assigned to it. Another part, though, is, tragedy, not evil. And this is a quotation, of course, from Robert Jervis, and I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with it. He spoke of it in an entirely different context, but I like it, and that's why I've included it. It's tragedy because it was unintended. It was unintended on part of the West, and it was unintended on part of Russia. There were these really high expectations. There were these numerous misunderstandings, and an opportunity was lost to establish, I believe, a true partnership based on shared identities and therefore also on shared interests. No one is really to blame for this. If we could redo it, we definitely should, and I think we need to learn from this. Hopefully we're entering a new phase where we can apply some of these insights and other insights, of course, so that we may avoid a similar situation. I think this is also a topic that calls for more research. If we could establish more solid foundation, what actually happened and why this happened at the time. I'll just give you one example. a big question, for instance, who won the Cold War? The U.S., for obvious reasons, insisted that it won the Cold War, and I think there's very good reason to support that claim. The Russians on the other side, of course, would argue that they were also the winners of the Cold War, that they had, from the inside, broken down the Soviet Union and therefore entered the ideological conflict that was the Cold War. And I think there's also a very good reason to support that view. But this whole question of who won the Cold War is part of this conflict that developed. And no one really is to blame for this. I think it was just misunderstandings, and as I said, and failed expectations. What Putin has done instead, and this is part of the psychotherapy, and I should add now I have two different identities. I actually see probably two and a half. So the half identity that we have in between, I see as something that was introduced before Putin, and it was a very crude negation of everything that the West was. So instead of liberalism, it would be non-liberalism. Instead of individualism, it would be non-individualism, and so on. I think Putin has taken this a step further and has turned these negative values or negations into positive values. And so now, instead of the Soviet Union as a constituting other, we have the West as the constituting other. Instead of liberalism, we have order. This is a false dichotomy, of course, but this is how I see that it's often presented. Instead of individualism, we have collectivism. Those observant among you will find that I've added now to the old identity consumerism. We could add also rationalism, for instance. But there are other elements that are now being seen as opposite to Russian spirituality, which I believe is also part of this new identity. And because the West is now seen as the constituting other, because identities are different, interests are also different. So there is rivalry. And some of this is summed up in the work by Vladislav Surkov on sovereign democracy. Whatever you think of Surkov and his ideology, I think this is a brilliant work. I think he is a brilliant ideologist. And I think the way that he has managed to put together a coherent framework for understanding Russia's position in the current world and its relationships with the West, I think is it's just great. Even if you don't like it, I think you have to admire the work. One term that he uses, a key term, for instance, is political competitiveness, and he draws that, of course, it's an analogy from microeconomics. He talks about political competitiveness, and what he explains in essence is that in the world today, every state will have to build up, set up a political system so that it may defend itself against others. Because it's a competitive world. Those who fail to set up domestic political systems so that they can defend themselves, they will fail. This is the essence of this. And so they explain that Russia, under current circumstances, cannot afford to have a Western-style democracy. It will weaken Russia. And this is simply why they cannot do so. This is why they have Russian-style democracy instead that is built on some of these principles. Some of these people go even further, and they argue that when the West back in the early 90s insisted that Russia should have a Western-style democracy, this was only to weaken Russia so that they could take advantage of it. Russia instead now has learned a lesson from this, so they argue. It's set up its own own political system that draws on more traditional Russian values, and they have successfully reshaped the Russian identity into something, at least so I see it, into something like this. This whole process, this is from an article in a German journal called Osteuropa, and it says, Ich hasse, also bin ich, for those of you who don't speak German, it says, I hate, therefore I am, which of course is really existential and very interesting and very fitting of this. This is actually an article on images of the U.S. in Russian media, and this was from 2002. So there was probably this process at this time. Again, this author doesn't use the term ontological security, but in essence, his argument is the same, of course. All right. Now, just for a few comments on what to do. The problem with this, now I mentioned the Arab-Israeli conflict, for instance, is that while we may recognize that it reduces material security, like physical security, the sense of increased ontological security may be so rewarding that we still accept it. People who work in security theory and psychologists often use the example of a woman who is in a violent relationship. And she may find that, she realizes, of course, that the relationship is violent and therefore damaging for her, but her sense of ontological security within the relationship is so strong that she decides to stay in the relationship. So divorcing her husband and setting up a new life, and what about our mutual friends and so on, is so distressing and so painful that she finds it really difficult to accept. And that's why we may have this paradox that an increase in ontological security may cause a decrease in material security, but it's something that is accepted. So how do we do about this? Well, first, we should build up trust, and it's very easy for me to say because I don't have to do this. As I said in the introduction, I did this article in Danish and I actually sent it to the Secretary General of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, who is, of course, a co-national of mine and who speaks Danish, and I hope that he's read it before the NATO-Russia summit, which is only 2 days from now. It has to do, I think, with the West in particular, and I think it's the main responsibility of the West. It could be of NATO, for instance. It's very important for me to add that I don't imply with this that the West is primarily to blame for any of this. I don't think so. But the West has a stronger sense of ontological security. We feel ontologically more secure. Whenever the Russians engage the West, whenever there is interaction, they bring out their core, the essence of who they are, they put on the table. And that makes it much more complicated. Sometimes, I guess, it makes it painful. We have a firmer understanding of who we are as liberal democracies. So when we interact with the Russians, we don't bring this to the table. As I said also earlier, I find, for instance, that with the whole renegotiation of our identities now with the process of EU enlargement and EU integration, our understanding of who we are is probably weaker than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. The same with immigration. And I think this is why we find throughout a number of EU member states right-wing parties, for instance, that play a dominant role. And this is because this is a painful process for us as well. But having said that, I still believe that ontologically we are more secure. And that's why I think we should make the first concessions. We should deny Russian critics proof that we do not like them. And one way of doing so could be to ignore provocations. We find these provocations everywhere. In Denmark, for instance, at least on a monthly basis, we have Russian strategic bombers that fly this close to Danish airspace. And I don't see any particular reason why they should do so, except for a provocation and the hope that it will elicit some kind of Danish response. We always send up F-16 fighter jets to accompany them, so they fly side by side until they turn off and they fly home. And I'm interviewed, for instance, on Danish television about this, and I always say, well, calm down. It's just a provocation. They don't intend any harm. And I think we should try to ignore some of these provocations. Another example could be the Russian-Venezuelan naval exercise that we had recently. The Russians sent, I believe, two or three vessels accompanied by a tow vessel so that if one of the Russian vessels broke down, they could bring it back to Russia. And the U.S. media, of course, jumped at this opportunity to make fun at the Russian Navy. And it was a good story, of course, that the Russian Navy apparently was in such a bad state that when they sailed all the way to Venezuela, they had to make sure that they could also return safely to Russia. And I think the whole naval exercise was merely a provocation. So instead of retaliating in this way, let's just wish them a happy exercise and leave it at that. We should break this vicious cycle of identity rejection. I think this is part of what happened back in the 90s, that we rejected each other and eventually grew still further apart. What happened with the Central European countries is that we had a positive identity recognition and eventually grew still closer. So by showing confidence in them, and they showed confidence in us, we were able to bridge the gap that actually existed between us. And there was also quite a considerable gap when the Warsaw Pact broke down, or when the Cold War ended. But through these positive identity recognitions, we were able to put an end to that. And now we don't see them, of course, as different from us. We should allow more symbolic roles, and I think it would be an excellent opportunity for the NATO Secretary General on Saturday, for instance, or in the NATO strategic concept, to allow symbolic roles for Russia. I'll be happy to discuss any concrete proposals for that, of course, as well. But something that the Russian side can bring home and say, look, they don't really hate us as much as we thought, and as we have told you earlier. At the same time, of course, they should close the door and they should tell Medvedev that if we deliver on this, if we make concessions, then you should also deliver in return. And we need to change, and I see small changes in this direction. We need to change the way that you talk about the West and the way that you use the West as a mirror image in this country, because that is also part of these identity rejections. And again, to show that we are not that different from them. Finally, before I end, I'll just add, this is again from Carl Rogers' book, and you may read it yourself. Essentially, what Carl Rogers says is that you should introduce, as a rule, whenever you have an interaction with other people, and if you get into a fight or conflict with these people, that you can only speak up once you have restated the position of the other party to the satisfaction of this person. And I think if this is a guiding principle for the NATO-Russia summit on Saturday, well, first of all, I believe it will be a very long summit, but I also believe that this could be a positive development. Obviously, this would never work, but this is from psychotherapy, and perhaps this is what we need at the present moment. All right. With that, I'll be happy to take your questions and comments.
Citizens, and that does to me, calls into question the assumption that Putin, or whoever it is, can read and is laying out this Russian ontological complex on the table with NATO, for example. To what extent they actually reflect the ontological complexes of citizens or the citizenry or Russia as a whole.
Mm-hmm. All right. First, on the West as a constituting other, yes, I agree with you. I think it operates in a way at different levels. They may go to the West. They may enjoy life in the West. They may even perhaps have internalized the values and norms of the West. In this case, if this is so, it would be very problematic for them, but not impossible, to portray the West as a constituting other. In the same way that I would find, for instance, that the former communist leadership of the Soviet Union portrayed the capitalist West as the constituting other, while probably believing in some of the principles. They may still admire the West, they may still have enjoyed life in the West. They may still have internalized perhaps the norms and values of the West, but it was convenient for them to hold on to a system and portray a constituting other that would sustain their power. So I see, yes, there may be problems, but it's not different from what we may find elsewhere. And the way that collectivities are organized and the way that their self-identification works, let's say in this country or in the West or in the Islamic Republic of Iran or in Saudi Arabia, they may still present themselves in one way and believe in something completely different. I'm not quite sure how that works, because I don't know what they believe in. I don't know what goes on in their minds. I do see, of course, and I think we all recognize this, that political leaders may have internalized other values and norms than those that they officially seem to present. On the question of the ontological security for the self, I should add, most of us probably didn't know that we need ontological security, even at the individual level. I didn't before I ran into this, I have to say. The ontological security at the collective level, and there may be different collective levels, is just one of a number of, well, we carry a vast number of identities. And the primary ones and those that give us our strongest sense and our most important sense of existence, ontological security, are those that are close to us. So this is just one out of a number of identities, and it would be peripheral to most of us. If individual leaders may have a completely different understanding of this, but that wouldn't change anything. So in this case, I speak, for instance, about the approximately 140 million Russian 140 million people in this country, or we would speak of the approximately 7 or so million Israelis. What individuals feel may be different, but this is as a collectivity. And their common and shared understanding of who they are. There may be people in this room who don't recognize anything that this government does and who doesn't support it and who will not feel part of this project. But that doesn't, unless it's a major part of the population, does not really challenge the identity and the ontological security.
We could go on that for a while.
Of course, it's very hard for me to speak in English, all these details, because this term in Russian philosophy calls samost, this internal identity. And what does it mean? Sam means only one. Sam is a very special word. you have this word in English. For example, assemble, sem, in this word, the stem means the same, make, whole. And of course, it's very difficult to, I agree with your thesis, or many of them. I even found in Russian poetry several verses by Pushkin who formulated all this ontological security in the beginning of the 19th century. In Russian it sounds like this. Я знаю, век уж мой измерен, но чтоб продлилась жизнь моя, я утром должен быть уверен, что с вами днем увижусь я. It's about love. I know that my lifespan is measured already, but in order life to be continued, I should be sure in the morning that I will see you in the day, later in the day. It's like with countries. And it's very pleasant that in NATO, in Western countries, you came to this question, because for Russia, it's usual way to think. Not for Russia, for Iran, Palestinians, Middle East, and other, because they understand that there is something like a face, like something core characteristic, and you cannot be sided from them, separated from them, and you should better be failed in the battle, but you need to battle just and to fight. And for example, when from Washington or European countries you use all these sticks for farming Ahmadinejad, you just, oh, okay, maybe he will be broken. We will see, maybe it will be nothing, just broke him and okay. And in this way, it's usual way conducting relations between the countries. Just provocation, but not to the last point, just up to the decision point. Then see, okay, this way. Okay, step back and see again in this way. For example, this policy was used by Europe in all these days after the Russian perestroika. Just Russia is nothing, just new state, no background, no ambitions, nothing. Just reformulated and rebuilt country. Of course, not Putin makes these core images of Russia. And no, not Putin or even Medvedev is thinking about the samost, about the internal core of Russia. In Russia, a lot of theories, a lot of persons who do it much more before Putin. It's like in Russian we have such a term, intelligentsia. It's those who meet. It's like for example, maybe if you can clergy, it's not the same term for the Western. It's those who is to explain who you are. For example, in my book on the whole life of Russia, I called the chapter of relations between Russia and Japan 150 years of misunderstanding. And we continue the same way. the same way. But in other questions, for example, question about Russia and China understand each other. So relations between China and... Because they accept the weight of the country, the opposite country, they accept the style of thinking, but Russia and China were on the edge of the even nuclear confrontation during the Vietnam-Chinese conflict. But nevertheless, both countries understand each other and understand that it's not good to provoke to the certain degree just be careful with this person, with this country, and so on, so on. So in this way, it's necessary. I think that it's a good analytical tool to understand the situations, and I think that it even good in order to see the program for relations between the countries, because it's necessary to understand, for example, Russia and Europe. It's also the question of misunderstanding, because in their core, they are very similar, because they are of the same civilization, and Russia and Europe do not understand the ancient stems of their civilization, because these stems are falsified completely. If we just started from the 15th, 16th century, at that time, from the 15th, 16th century, we always were the countries who in competition just for Baltic Sea, just for colonies, and so on, so on, many questions. But really, we have a lot in the our nature, the same, for example, same from the same stem, same, and it's necessary to understand this samest between our countries, and it's good tool, and thank you, I think it's interesting way to understand it. Thank you for your report.
For this wonderful presentation, and I think it was very useful because it's a good way to think about things. We simplified a little, and it helps to understand. And in the first place, I like to say that it has to do something with self-perception, self-conception. That has to do a lot with psychology and also philosophy. And when thinking about Russian identity, it's good to see it from the point of view of Russia. At the same time, to understand how the West sees Russian identity. It's like, you know, you will see that something's wrong with you when you look in the mirror. You can't realize something's wrong with you unless you really look at yourself and see the reflection. So as the West, it's interesting how you see the recipe, you know, to regain our identity. Because Russia is a paradox, and there are two extremities. You know, those who have power, and it's extreme, you know, they're not afraid, and all the rest that are afraid. And in order to have maybe something in general, to have this general idea of what Russia is and who we are and what we should do, you know, to become real Russia, it's good to understand it from both ways, from both perspectives. It's good to have this cultural awareness, you know, and understand each other better. How you see us and who we are, and what would your recipe be? You know, shall we impose something, you know, from the level of government, or shall we as individuals, you know, try to work on ourselves and understand more, ask more questions to ourselves in the first place? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, I would like to add that in order to get a firmer understanding of this myself and also present this in a way so that people who are not familiar with the term may understand it more fully, I draw on psychology, psychotherapy, where it originates. And I realize, of course, this is very problematic because I end up, or risk ending up, giving the people the idea that Russia is sick. And I don't think so. And this is not what it suggests. What it suggests is that Russia has been, and to some extent perhaps still is, unsure about what it actually is. Or the Russian population, why are we here? Why do we actually, what do we do together as a group, as a collectivity? And this is a process that is that may be seen in different ways, well, among different collectivities. As I suggested in Denmark right now, for instance, you may find it in Sweden, perhaps in Austria. We may be in a painful process of trying to reconcile our traditional understanding of who we are with the challenges of immigration and European immigration and European integration, and that doesn't make us sick. It just means that we are in this painful process, as I think the Russians have been, and to some extent still are. What should be done? Well, as I suggested, and as I said, it's very easy for me to do. Allow more symbolic roles, at least to start. I gave a presentation. This was actually the same presentation with this man who was furious and said this was really vulgar. And another person in the audience was also quite upset. So overall, it's a really bad day for me. But another person in the audience was also upset and said, well, what if this other actor, in this case Russia, turns into be a hardened criminal? Then what do you do? And they talked about the war in Georgia and gas supplies that were being interrupted and so on. If the other actor turns out to be a hardened criminal, then symbolic roles will not do. Then obviously you need something else. And what that is, I really don't know. When we had our presentation just before this, Dimitri Trinin and Sangreen talked also about conditionality, and they said that you may try to impose conditionality on Russia, but it will not work. And Russia is in a state today where it finds itself capable of rejecting or not accepting any type of conditionality. So it's hard for us to impose ourselves. I would say that in the same way that Sam suggested with politicians, for instance, other people who go to the West and who enjoy life in the West, some of this eventually, I think, will rub off on the Russian population. Personally, for the medium term, I'm quite pessimistic for this country. But for the long term, I'm definitely optimistic. And whenever I go, I do see small changes. And I think there are important processes out there that will have an impact on the Russian population as well. And it will not happen today or tomorrow, but 10 years from now, 20 years from now, it will be quite different. Also on the... I just need to comment on the... Well, first of all, thank you very much for the Pushkin quote. I need to look at that. On China, I wrote an article in Denmark following the terrorist attacks on New York and Washington on 9/11, 2001, predicting that international terrorism, as we know it today, may reshape the Russian and Western understanding of each other. That instead of the existing sort of constituting others, a new constituting other, a shared constituting other has emerged. Unfortunately, it proved not to be right, but that's how it is. Often I'm wrong. I actually do see China probably in the future as something, as an actor that may serve as a constituting other for Russia, and an actor that will show the Russian population that the West is actually not that different. I think Russian politicians today are portraying China as a close ally of Russia and as a state that thinks in the same way as Russia do. I don't think they do, and I think there is in Russia a sense that while you may understand the West with the mind, with the intellect, China is an entirely different issue. And I think this eventually, not that I would want it, of course, but I think eventually may serve to transform the relationship between Russia and the West. But this is also for the long term.
Colonel Schulz of Swiss Embassy, thank you very much for your ideas. I would like to know, when you apply your tools, your methods to today's reality, what do you think is the outcome of the NATO-Russia summit or the NATO summit in 2 days?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I should say, of course, that even if Anders Fogh Rasmussen read my piece, probably he did not, it has no impact on the NATO-Russia summit. And these ideas, similar ideas, will have little impact. But I do think, hope and expect, that there will be symbolic roles assigned to Russia in the at the summit, and I hope that the Russian side will reciprocate and also allow for symbolic roles for the West, and to talk about the West, to portray the West, to have a different narrative. If only a small step, because it's true, of course, if you build your political career on a particular narrative, you should be very careful not to dismantle it. So this will have to be done step by step. But I would expect and also hope that there will be some kind of Russian reciprocation. It could also be included in the NATO strategic concept, and the way that Russia is portrayed in the NATO strategic concept, the way that NATO will talk about Russia as an actor, the challenges that Russia poses, but also the positive effects that Russia can bring, for instance, to the international security system, or through joint actions somewhere, let's say Afghanistan. We started doing operations together with the Russians in Afghanistan, which is highly positive, also very symbolic. It has little effect, but it's very symbolic, and I think that's a positive step. So I hope and expect that NATO will have something concrete, symbolic, but still concrete, for the NATO-Russia summit. And again, I hope and expect that there will be something in the strategic concept.
From the Spanish Embassy, I'm a political counselor. And thank you very much for your illuminating presentation. And I found it very Socratic in the sense that you advocate for a sort of joint pursuit of truth, of identity, sort of interaction with the aim of reaching out of ourselves. But I mean, my wife is Russian, so I'm very much acquainted with probably about the Russian self,
yes,
and the search for itself, etc., etc. But I mean, the ontological question now is not only for Russia to answer this, for all of us. I mean, my view is that the pace of change in the world is so rapid now that all our ontological certainties have been lost. Mm-hmm. Have been lost in the sense that we don't know what the future will be. We don't know what opportunities we will have. We don't know what opportunities our children will have. I don't know whether in 15 years the world will look like this or quite the opposite. And in this sort of accelerated historic change, the West, United States and Europe, and Russia has been at loggerheads for too long a time. And in that quarrel among themselves, my view is that they have consumed a lot of energy and forces, and all of a sudden they have awakened to the real world in which you have Brazil, you have China, you have India, you have Thailand, you have Peru, you have Burundi, and all of a sudden the rest is rising, and we find our position when compared to them, Russia and the West, slightly weakened. So we are confronted to the need of joining efforts in order to reach out of ourselves and to build some sort of unity to compete politically, as you said. I mean, this is a political competition. To build some sort of political body which would be more competitive than the West model or than the Russian model. I mean, in my view, the Soviet model was a poor political model. The Russian model is not so brilliant as it seems. And the West is in economic decline because of financial problems, the price of the welfare state, etc., etc. I mean, for different reasons, we find ourselves compelled to cooperate, to understand one another, and to find common ground. I mean, and all the sense of drama about the next NATO summit, in my view, consists on that. I mean, the West and Russia have understood that they have to join efforts in order to be competitive. Why have they chosen one another to be partners? Because they have very much in common. I mean, despite all the contradictions, all the rivalries, all the different values, I mean, Russia and the West have very much in common. And I don't know whether what will come out of the Lisbon summit, but I mean, this is, in my view, a trend that is much bigger than ourselves. And I mean, it's something that we cannot fight against, because it's the only way that we could manage to be politically competitive. But I mean, your presentation was very much illuminating because it made me think of Hegel. So thank you very much.
I wish the leadership of the Republican Party in Washington could hear that, because I'm not sure that this lesson has gone on everybody. But there's an aspect that I want to draw out and amplify. And I wish, unfortunately, we had a German in the room, because it gets to the question of to what extent is this a predetermined process? I think I know your answer, but I just want to push you on it, because the sort of coming at this from an almost pathological or a medical angle seems to suggest that if you had enough data, if you had enough information, you could calculate ahead of time where this focal point, this sort of ontological equilibrium, the supply and demand curve would lie, and then you could save everybody a lot of time by saying, Russia needs to go from point A to point B, and maybe Europe as well. You also suggest that these things can move, they can change. To what extent is this a predetermined process, and to what extent is there an aspect of chance and agency and people realizing that that there are opportunities in other processes beyond the processes in our heads that play into this?
Okay. So let me start by that. There's lots of agency in this. These structures exist. They are passed down to us. But there is lots of agency. So, if I put it in another way, we as groups may actively, of course, transform the way that we see ourselves. And most often we do. Perhaps not deliberately, but because of certain forces that have an impact on us. But it's also true that an overall structure exists so that what it means for me or today, in what it means for the Danish nation to exist and how it sees itself is quite different from what it was two generations ago, but it's not fundamentally different. So certain aspects, of course, are passed down. This is what I refer to as a structure, but there is still agency because you can transform it, and you can do so in different ways. Skillful people, and I don't mean this in a negative way, may influence this, of course. When I'm at my hotel, I turn on the news and I see Euronews. And this is a way, of course, of giving us a sense of being Europeans. We have politicians who tell us that this is so. We have politicians who tell us that we should never accept this. We have, in general, we may refer to them as norm entrepreneurs, so people who try who bring out norms and who want us to behave in a particular way. So it may be changed also skillfully. Most of us don't get together and say, let's change our identity, let's do something about our ontological security. But it's there all the time, even if it's unspoken. To answer your question, I see lots of structure, but I also see lots of agency, which falls, of course, within this social constructivist paradigm as well, and which means that it may change, and it does change all the time. It's constantly being renegotiated, as I said. Let me just add to the comments about contemporary life, which I think is really interesting, and so it has to do, if I understand you correctly, with ontological security under conditions of globalization. And someone actually has looked at this. Anthony Giddens has written, not extensively, but has written some on ontological security under present conditions, but only for the individual. So he talks about the individual's lack of ontological security because of the forces that you mentioned, that we are disembedded. So we are removed from places that otherwise and in formally would give us a very firm understanding of who we are. And it's a great topic, of course, and I need to think about this. But overall, if you look at collectivities under conditions of globalization, ontological security for collectivities under conditions of globalization, that's a fantastic research topic. And I agree with you. It's something that it has a great influence, definitely.
Thank you so much. Your presentation just reminded me of my own speech in 1991. I used to speak in the Kennedy Library for just ordinary American public. And I spoke about the necessity for Americans to be more patient and to develop more trust to us. It was just feelings. And asking myself why they're forced to be more patient, I had no answer. Really, your presentation somehow gave me the answer, but at the same time, you showed me the gap, which is so deep, which I don't know, is Russia in position to bridge the gap or not? Just so questionable. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that, and thank you for your warm words. I think Russia is in a position to bridge this gap, but only if people will. And if there are politicians who either believe that this is true or skillfully manipulate the political agenda, then it could be really, it could prove very complicated. So if Russia insists, as I see it, that the West is the constituting other today, and I really only see this as the constituting other, then that's very problematic. What the EU has done, of course, and it may be different if you ask people, if you stop people in the street and you say, what is the constituting other of the EU? Some people, I am sure, would say Russia. Others would say the Middle East, perhaps. But officially, the way it's being promoted, the constituting other of the EU is Europe's own past, which, of course, is very politically correct, but it's also a very nice way of putting it. We don't identify anyone in the world today as our mirror image. We say whatever they are, we are not. But we are. We refuse to be what we used to be. In the same way, of course, that Russia could also actively, Russian politicians, normal entrepreneurs in general, could actively distance themselves and the Russian population from what was before. So I think it can be done, but only if there is a will to do so.
So thank you very much for your brilliant presentation. Since my colleagues here have already spared their comments on that, just I have a few remarks. Something from your presentation and in regard of your comment on NATO summit in Lisbon. That I'm not sure it has a direct connection with what we're discussing now, but nevertheless. When you were speaking about individual security, just something came to my mind. So today I was lecturing at my defense university. And one of my military cadets, just raised a very interesting question, a very interesting issue, which may be a handful right now. He mentioned that about our political culture, that we stopped killing each other in Russia here, in the Soviet Union, only in 1952. You see, so that I am trying to quote him. And so when we are discussing the problem of our political culture and the problem of our individual security, so we are speaking about the formation of a new political culture, because we don't have those traditions that the West had, but that doesn't mean that we don't want to have individual security. We are only on the way to formulate them, to forge and to form that. And we have a very little period from that, so we have only 50 years at our disposal just to do that. So actually, practically, so we are on that way. That means that we have a kind of a gap between the Western culture, political culture, and the culture in Russia. So which, and we, when we speak about that, we have at least just have that into account, for one. And so you've just now, so you said about, so you are very optimistic about that Russian NATO summit, so in Lisbon.
Fairly optimistic.
So in, you are trying to rely on that Russian, very, that's that Russian, joint Russian NATO operations in Jalalabad, so which have taken recently. I, as an expert on Afghanistan and Iran, so I can tell you that I believe it is only an exception from the rule, because if NATO believes that Russia is intending just to deploy its forces in Afghanistan, so this is overestimating our abilities, at least. So even if we wish to, so we don't have any abilities, and those who have some plans about that, so is trying just to involve Russia and Europe into a new round of the game, for which we are not ready, practically. So we, and not speaking about the fact that we have a very good experience for us, and so that region is not so popular so with Russian population. Yes. And if Russian leadership tries just to help someone in that respect, it will find itself very distant from the Russian population. And I don't believe the Russian leadership can so just can do that so without any fear. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for those. Thank you for those comments. I agree on the Russian contribution to Afghanistan is exceptional in this sense, but I can guarantee you, and I don't speak, of course, on behalf of anyone, but this is my reading, no one expects Russia to commit itself on any large scale in Afghanistan. Your point, though, about the Russian politicians and the problems that they face with regards to this is very interesting, and it echoes, I think, what I said earlier about the politicians, that they, if they want to dismantle the whole setup that they have established with the West as the constituting other, in order to preserve any kind of legitimacy, they can only do so step by step. It would have to be very cautious. So you cannot rush to Afghanistan. You cannot rush into cooperation with NATO. It would have to be in a way so that the Russian politicians can face and show that this is not a rejection or negation of what they have said earlier. On the individual security, this is it's partly related, of course, to this notion of ontological security. I think Russia could have achieved more if more of these so-called norm entrepreneurs had stood up earlier and will stand up today to defend the individual. This is, everything can be learned, not necessarily by each individual within a given lifespan, but in general everything can be learned. And you can learn to respect the individual, you can also learn not to respect the individual, if only it's done in the proper way. So I think I believe that if more people had stood up against this process of de-individuation, that would have been positive and might have changed the outlook or the situation as we see it today. It may change again, of course. The Russian population is not some kind of machine that operates in a machine-like manner. These are people who can learn, and they can learn by themselves, and they can also learn by example.
The question is that, unfortunately, we are talking about the Russian stand and Western stand like different in the, such a qualification. Russian is poor, stand in this way and Western is better. But it's in logic, it's wrong way of understanding situation because there is a different stages of the development of societies, collectivities, and so on. We are not those who just 15 years to ask questions. Because if you will compare, like that one, if you will compare the, for example, the 20th century, two wars, great wars, a lot of casualties, victims, and so on. Is it of Russian fault? No. Is it of Iranian fault? No. Is it of Palestine fault? No. It's European. It's from inside of Europe. A lot of victims, a lot of... and now it's okay, let's forget and see how those in Africa or in the Middle East or somewhere, they're trying to do their modernization and so on. Okay, now it's, of course, I'm not agree with those in Iran who try to use stone to kill women. But at the beginning of the 20th century, the same situation was in America. Just used to see. It's not the problem. Just look some. Come back to up to the beginning of the to at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 12th century. Just try to compare, and you will see that situation not so much changed. If you a little bit ahead, and you now used to, for example, make gay parade in Moscow. Not problems. Maybe it will be much. Maybe in 50 years, you will use to make this gay party in Washington because they will be against, because situation is changing, and this is the problem. And now it's not when we spoke about the civilization. We shouldn't use such a like it's better, it's worse, and so on. They are different, of course, but we need to use all these our skills to, like, you're, for example, you are from the marine country. When you want to be in a port to make your ship be safe, just coming to the shore coast, you should be very careful. Use this rope, that rope, just different speed of the engines and so on. But when you're discussing all this question, you use one speed, one way, and one skill just to press your speed pedal. It's if we're discussing this question, for example, of course, we stopped. So we our problems, for example, of Russian modernization with the Stalin type of modernization. It's not so, it's of course a lot of the problems. It's huge and our country is broken by this situation. But let's see what you have in England, you have in Holland and so on. You have much more time to oil these wounds. But situation is the same. So let's not use such a, it's better or worse, and not try to make all people like in Olympic Games, just we are starting from the same point. We are not on the race. Each race, fresh race, but if civilization don't use the fresh race each time. They have their history. They have all these handicaps and all these problems in their heritage. And if you just trying to, let's forget. We have rules, please use these rules to behave here. It's maybe not a good way. It's just way to the same, like in the, for example, not Hitler time, but we have two world wars in Europe. It's a lot. I hope third will be stopped.
Can I say just a few words before you?
Of course.
What about Europeans who were guilty because of two wars? Russia was a big country. Russia was involved in the process in the beginning of the First World War.
It was the decision of Russia to participate, and Russia was involved. Surely.
Yes, of course. You can count only Europeans killed in that war. Russia will be for their own guilty of their own. But
no.
Just try to continue to understand that all the situation.
We were part of the process.
Yes, of course. We're always part of the process
the
because.
We're trained.
I don't say about the guilty. I said not about the Russians and Europeans because I understand that we from the same Christian culture. But I usually use those Middle East, maybe Africa, maybe other place, with whom it's necessary to calculate and compare.
This is the reason why this is not a linear process. Yeah. And I would come immediately to the speaker's defense and say that there were no normative judgments in the presentation. Normative judgments came up in the conversation later, and not on the part of Mrs. Fleming. But if you want to...
Yeah, well, just briefly, let me just say that I welcome your comments, but I have to say I disagree with you fundamentally. I don't believe in cultural relativism, and I think we need to set, however difficult this may be, I recognize this, some kind of cultural standard. And having said that, it also implies, and let's not talk about Russia because that's a sensitive issue, that standards in many ways are lower in the Republic of Iran that you mentioned than they are in Switzerland, for instance. I think we can agree on this. And this we do, of course, by comparing it, by evaluating it according to a set standard. Let me just say also on the... now you mentioned, you used this fantastic metaphor of a race, the starting line, and I like this. I do think, however, the Russians could have run a bit faster. And I think in recent years they've started running the other way, which is very unfortunate. And things, as I said, can be learned. Everyone can learn, in principle, everything. And you should be careful, we should. When you talk about the cultural heritage, I recognize this, of course. We all know that it does play an important role. The term that is used for this often in the literature is path dependence. So path dependence tells us or the way that we have acted in the past is what we automatically revert to when we are faced with some kind of challenge. And Russian history, for some, has taught you that this is the appropriate action when faced with a given challenge. You should keep in mind, though, that this is the same kind of logic, path dependence, that people use when they say Russia can never change. That Russia was... is and always will be an imperialistic state that we cannot trust. This is also path dependence. So this is just to suggest that it works both ways, and we should be extremely careful with path dependence, however we use it.
I think it's something we can all agree on, and on that I would say we can wrap up the formal part of our seminar. There are through those doors and in the back, light refreshments, and I would invite everybody to continue informally. But first, I'd like to thank our speaker.
Thank you.
And all of you for your participation. Thank you.
Thank you.